the Feminvest podcast. My name is Michaela Berglund and I'm the CEO of Feminvest. And I'm a little bit tired today, I must admit. I was in Copenhagen yesterday together with the grant holders of Visa She's Next and celebrating their work and learning more about the different challenges they have from scaling their businesses. And we are touring around in Scandinavia with this initiative. And next up is Oslo in the upcoming week. So I'm really excited about that. What really strikes me when we are out and about meeting entrepreneurs in that regard is that there are something very special happening when women get together. But on the other hand, last week we hosted Fearless, the large event that we do four times a year. The last week it was in Gothenburg, and I had the honor to listen to a couple of men talking about the importance of equality and women's ownership. And afterwards, one of the guys reached out to me and said, "Wow, Michaela, I'm so overwhelmed by the response I've received by all the women saying thank you for actually taking the stand in public. And you know, working with Feminvest on this mission to ensure that women own more and know how to own more." And I realized that, you know, it's great that we gather as women occasionally, and we will continue to facilitate that meeting place. But it's also amazing when men step out and talk about the importance and how they want to contribute to the mission of women being more secure and confident in making financial decisions. So I've had a really great week. The next Fearless event is in Oslo on the 25th of April. So if you listen to this podcast, wherever you are in Europe, you're more than welcome to come and join that meeting place. There will be between 300 and 500 women at that event. We'll have pitches on stage by women entrepreneurs. There will be investment juries. There will be talks about what's happening in the stock market. And we'll also talk about equality in the stock market, actually, because like what companies are actually taking responsibility in terms of equality across the globe? And how is that a driving factor in profitability? I'm very excited to have an intriguing conversation this week with a woman that are also diving into this topic in different ways. She is, among other things, she's written a book, Women Are Worth It. And she is writing this book to encourage women to make progress and take steps by pursuing investing. And investing both in the stock market and saving on a monthly basis. And I read a little bit of a copy around the book and I thought it was really interesting. So I wanted to read it in this forum. Nowadays, women have control over so many aspects of our life. We've fought hard to effect meaningful change, the right to own property, the right to work, the right to vote, the right to divorce and live independently. But there is something missing. Our independence and freedom are in part dependent on achieving financial control as well. And studies show that women are better investors than men. And a lot of studies show, obviously, that women are not feeling super confident when it comes to making financial decisions. And I saw this quote that is from Dave Ramsey that said, "Taking control of your money is about emotion, not intellect. You must believe passionately in the outcome." And perhaps I think this is a great way to start this conversation. And I'm so happy to have you, Sarah Jean Quand. Welcome to the podcast. And what do you think when you hear me talking about this topic?
Yeah, my conclusion is, well, first, thank you for having me, Michaela. My conclusion is, I think it's what led me to write this book, is that it's very important to provide a financial education for women, not only women, but everyone. And also it starts with women, but then also our children, in order to make sure that everyone can be financially independent. Because in the world we are living today, in a way, you know, money is a source of power. And I've seen so many women struggle into an unhappy marriage that they don't want to leave or do anything, and they will stay just because they don't have the financial independence or the financial control. So it is a subject that is really dear to my heart. As you can see, I speak with it with passion.
Yeah. And you refer to something that you describe as the vicious cycle. Can you describe that to the listeners?
Yes. So when I start writing the book, I thought, okay, I want to understand, what's the stage of, what's happening with women and money. And then I start doing a lot of research, of course. And my idea was to give some tips and tricks on how to build an investment portfolio, right? But then when I'm reading, I realized when I did the research that there was something before learning how to invest that needed to be tackled. And that was, what was impeding the woman to actually have access to stock market. And by doing the research, not only reading on it, but also interviewing lots of women, starting with my clients, but then all the people around me as well, I've realized that there are mainly three things that impede women to start investing. And it's kind of a vicious circle because each of these feed into each other. And it starts with lack of interest and lack of confidence. But all those things go together because, of course, when you are not interested into a subject, you're not going to learn about it. And then if you don't have the knowledge, then of course you're not going to feel confident that you can do it. So it's a vicious circle in a way that, it all feeds each other. And maybe also there are some historical reason, for a lack of interest. I don't know how it is in Sweden, but in Switzerland, women were not allowed to open a bank account without the approval of their husband until the late 70s. So of course it does have an impact on, whether we are interested into a subject or not. When you don't have the access to deal with money, of course you're, why bother in a way? So
And I
that was my
also think,
idea, is like, okay, how can I stop this vicious circle and, turn it into a positive circle? So that's why I tackled the knowledge by writing the book.
yeah, it is interesting because I think you can even flip the terms around. Like we are not feeling confident, hence we are not interested. Like the insecurities comes first, and that means that we are not investing the time to learn about it because we don't believe that we would understand it or it's overwhelming, So
Yes, and that was my idea, is how do I turn the tide around? How do I make women interested in the stock market? How do I give them the knowledge? And by w working on those, then self-confidence will finally show up. Because I don't remember who said that, but I read this quote quite a bit that says, nothing, when women have more money, nothing gets bad. Everything gets better. So that's the idea.
To your thoughts on how we can get more women to invest in, by providing knowledge and normalizing investing and highlighting the importance of doing so. What has been the result that you received after working on creating a change?
Yes, so there is also one thing on top of this vicious circle that what I call the financial myth is the way that we look at finance. And I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. Just usually when I go and meet new people in an informal setting, and people ask me, okay, what do you do for a living? And then I pronounce the word financial advisor. That's when it gets a bit like, oh, you look nice until you said that word, right? Kind of as if it's a big word. And I think that's what I call the financial myth, is what is our image of finance? And it's not only women, and there is a lot of men that are in the same situation, but it's basically how do we view finance? It's like, oh, finance is this complex word, right? It's something that, doesn't add up to my value. In a way, it's not about the a lot. I hear a lot of money talk, women talking about, when they even talk about negotiating their salary, they're like, oh, but Sarah, it's not about the money. No, it's not about the money, but money is an enabler. It helps us, it's a tool, it helps us achieve things, right? And women are really good at budgeting, they're really good at saving, but then they have all those savings and then they don't do anything on it because they are afraid of, losing on the stock market. They are afraid that they don't know what to do, because also that's everything you see in the newspaper. You have all those headlines, then you have stories like Madoff, and a lot of those things can be scary. But that's also because we don't give access of information on how to invest in a way that is, long term, that is looking at maybe simple product and understanding the basics. And the financial industry has been so good at making all of this so complex. When we talk about hedge funds, funds of fund, forex, options, all this vocabulary can be a bit overwhelming. So, that was my idea also for the book, is how can we just start with the basics? And you don't need to be a financial expert to start investing. The same way that, you don't need to be a mechanical expert to drive a car. When you drive your car, you look at the dashboard, and when something is not good with the motor or something goes wrong with the motor, you go to the specialist. Well, you should do the same thing when you're, driving your financial or controlling your financial life, is have a financial dashboard, make sure you understand the key indicator, and you can rely on expert, but rely on expert, but make sure you understand what they do, that they feel accountable. Don't hand them a blank check, I would say.
Yeah, that's really interesting. If you look at hands-on advice, because I think, we want to move the needle for women to actually, okay, I'll start today. So how should one start build a portfolio according to you?
So it's a very large question, because it's could be very personal, and I'm just going to take the analogy of the car again here. It's a bit like if you ask me, okay, what is the best type of car to buy in the market? And I'd be like, well, it depends what you want to do with it, right? If you are going up in the mountain a lot, you probably will need a 4x4 car. If you are spending a lot of time in the city, maybe you want a smaller car. If you have a family, then you may want to have a 7-seat car. And why am I making this analogy? It's a bit of the same when you want to build your portfolio. First, you need to start with your personal objective, is what do you need this money to work for you to do what? What is Do you need it to put it a down payment for a house? Is it something to finance the study of a children? Is it for your retirement? And you need to start with your personal objective, because it's important that the portfolio works for you and not the other way around. You want to make sure that, let's say that your objective is because you want to finance a trip, or you want to finance your summer holiday for the next 10 years. You want to make sure that you are not dependent on what's happening on the stock market to live your life. Let's say you have a bad year, you still want to be able to afford to go on holiday. That's why you need to make sure that you first start with your personal objective, and then you build a portfolio that is aligned to it, that is, working for your personal objective. So, the studies have shown that, 94% of the performance depends on the risk profile. So that's the most important decision that you need to take. And your risk profile will depend on when do you need the money. The more time you have, let's say it's the money that it's the savings you have for your retirement, and let's say you retire in 20 years, then you can take a lot of risk, because you have the time to wait for the market to recover. Let's say that you need the money next year to put a down payment for a house. I would recommend not to invest it in the stock market, because of course, within 12 months, the stock market can go up, but it can go down as well. While over a period of, 10 or 20 years, for sure that the markets will go up. I don't know if I know it doesn't give a specific answer, but that's the starting point.
That says that, start now, because with starting now, you'll have more time to work with. So
The
it's
best time to invest is yesterday, right?
exactly.
Start now, and even with a small amount, because compound interest is the most important thing. Let's say you are 20 years of age and you have a couple of
50 euro, 100 euro on your save, or Swedish krona, I don't know, depending on where you are in your saving account.
I started with
Start
two
with
hundred
small.
Swedish kroner. Yeah, I started with 200
Exactly.
Swedish kroner a month when I was 19.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And if you start when you are 19, you have a lifetime ahead of you, and you have the force of the time working in your favor. So start small, but start, do something. Especially now, there's the technology that everyone can start investing within, even with small amounts. 50 years ago, we didn't have this technology. So you had to go into a bank, and it cost a lot of fees, etc. So start now, even with a small amount.
But if someone would listen to you and I now and consider, okay, I should get started. It's the end of the month. I probably have some salary left in my bank account. If I would start, it might seem like a risky time because, it's a war in Europe.
Yes.
There is
Yeah.
a political uncertainties. Are Biden or Trump going to win? How is that going to influence the financial markets? And we got inflation that's been coming down, but it's not completely a threat that's out of the picture yet. But what's your thoughts on the current situation in the stock market?
Yeah, that's a very good question because the truth is we never know when is the, I mean, if someone knew in advance when was the best time to enter the market to invest, probably those people would be, laying on the beach somewhere drinking from a coconut, right? And that's the thing is you never know when it's the good time. We just know that the longest you stay invested, the best, the better you get out of it. But with your question with regards to the current event on the stock market is a lot of time we are focusing on what's happening now because we're living in the moment. But if you look at the history of, the stock market and the history of, the world, there has always been war. There has always, every 4 years, there are uncertainty about election in the US, or election somewhere else. There's always this uncertainty about economic and what's happening. Lately, we went through pandemic when COVID hit in 2020, and everyone in the stock market was freaking out. They thought, oh, it's going to be the worst year ever. And when you look at the year 2020, performance was not that bad, after all. So a lot of time, we try to take political or economic events to try to explain what's happening in the stock market, when a lot of time there is no link or direct link to it. It's just that the irrational and the emotional thing that comes through it. Just to give you another example, during COVID, I thought it was so funny because I think it was November, October, November in 2020, when the prices of the airline, of all airline that like you could look at EasyJet, British Airways, etc. They were raising, right? Raising on the stock market while all the airplane were stuck in the airport. So sometimes there is a lot of irrationality in the market. And it's always easy to answer to explain what has happened after it has happened, but not a lot of people can forecast what's really happening in the stock market. And there is this quote that says that forecaster in the stock market and fortune teller are a bit of the same. Is they have in common is that they are trying to forecast something, but for sure you don't know. So sometimes you can be right and sometimes you can be wrong. And yes, there is inflation, there is war in Ukraine, there is a lot of things going on, but it has always been like that. And if you look back at all the events for the next last 10 or 20 years, each year, when you look at headline, there are lots of things going on, lots of instability. So start investing whenever you have the money to start investing, and don't worry about that. The less you listen to the noise of the media, the better investor you're going to be.
Amazing final words from you. Thank you, Sarah, for being in the podcast today. Where can one find you in the book?
The book is on sale in Amazon and on my website. And I'm physically based in Geneva, but you can find me on LinkedIn or Facebook, and I'll be happy to have a chat with anyone who wants to start investing because sometimes you just need to have a little bit of accountability to get the kickoff. And my mission is really for each and every woman to start investing in the stock market. And sometimes just a 15 minutes coffee can just give you the incentive to start doing it and to be independent and do it on your own. So I hope that the people that are listening, it will give you the incentive to put yourself into action.
Thank you so much, Sarah. We will continue the podcast with another part that we have every episode. And it's about diving into an entrepreneur that is sharing a little bit of her thoughts on her business, what she's doing, why she's doing it, and her mission on scaling the company. So over to Saba.
Hi, and welcome everyone back to a new episode of the Feminvest podcast and the interview with a new entrepreneur. And today with me, I do have Madeleine Bjørnestad-Rode. She is the CEO and co-founder of Stack by Me, and she has more than 11 years of experience in finance and actually also a double master's degree in finance and international management from the Norwegian School of Economics. And Madeleine, welcome to the podcast. You're one of our expat members from Oslo, and I'm happy you're here.
Thank you for the nice welcome.
Let's see. Let's start with you presenting a little more about your background, Madeleine, and what you have been doing before you came up with the revolutionary platform, if I would say, the Stack by Me.
So my background, as you mentioned, I have a double master's degree in finance and international management. And from there, I went to work in management consulting for half a year in something called Quartz, which is now Bain & Company. That was too soft for me. So I actually quite quickly applied for a job with an investment bank called Pareto. And it was just a fluke. I saw that they had an ad out and used some friends there. And I wanted to work more with numbers. So I only applied there and I got the job and I started there. And it was a very, very interesting change of scenery coming from, you know, management consultancies. They have like really, really nice offices and, you know, all kinds of like benefits and, you know, social events and training programs. And it's a really, really nice start. And then you came right into investment banking where, I mean, the offices were really, really old. They didn't spend money on anything. They just paid out huge bonuses. It's a very, very well paid job. But I came in there and there were only men. I think we were like five women out of 250 people in the entire Oslo office. And the first thing anyone says to me, because I was walking around with the HR lady, she was showing me around. And of course, we had the same dress on that day. And so the first thing anyone ever said to me there was, oh, are we going to have more women in tight black dresses around here now?
Interesting.
The welcome. I really, really liked that job, actually. It grew on me, and they refurbished their offices and everything. But this was Pareto Securities back in the day. And I spent some months there on the M&A desk working with sort of oil service M&A. And then they asked if anyone wanted to start a Paris office. And surprisingly enough, I know you Swedes are more open to working in London and abroad. Norwegians are not in general. People really, really like to just live in Norway and stay in Oslo or maybe even Bergen. So I was the only one who raised my hand. And so, of course, I got to go after a long discussion with my husband, who actually said no to go to Paris. But in the end, it was really, really cool. We went to Paris. He went to INSEAD and I commuted for some months. Then he was there with me during his INSEAD period, which is a business school. For those who don't know that, he's an engineer by background. So that was good for him. He's usually a very, very know-it-all, but I really felt that it was kind of cute when he came to me and he asked me what IRR was. And I'm like, oh, I can tell you something. So that was really, really nice. We built up this office in Paris together with a ship broker. It was a joint venture. And so we were trying to do sort of project finance and corporate finance deals with their shipping clients all over Europe. So it was a really, really cool time. Got to live in Paris. Drink a lot of wine with these old-fashioned shipbrokers. It was really old school. They had wine for every lunch meal. And we went to Spain and Italy and Monaco, and we were all over. Really nice time. And then when I came back from Paris, having sort of finished setting up the office, we hired some local guys. It was sort of time to leave and go back to the real world of Norway. And when I came back, My boss, so the partner I was working with in Paris, he was still in Paris. And so they asked me if I would start working with this new partner, actually a woman who had come from, she had started in Pareto from Nordea. And you know, when you work in Nordea, which is, you know, a large bank, you usually have like a big team of juniors working for you. And I mean, she'd worked herself up the ranks of Nordea, Lisa Carlson. And so she was used to having like a team who would do stuff for her, and she would just like plan and talk to clients. And in Pareto, she was just, she calls it, I felt like I was a goldfish being dropped into a bowl with eels.
Wow.
And she was like, I felt like an experiment. They would just see how long I could survive and if I would swim when they put me in there. But fortunately, we found each other. And we worked really well together. We started something called the private equity coverage team, where we basically covered her old clients for Nordea within private equity and did mostly bond deals. And it was that working with debt capital markets for 3 years with Lisa, which brought me over to my next role, which was in Pareto Asset Management. They had great success with their Nordic high yield funds internationally. And so they needed someone to build up the same presence in the UK. And so it was sort of building up a new market, and I would have my own clients. So I thought it was a really interesting challenge, having worked sort of setting up a Paris office, having been sort of the number two in setting up the private equity coverage team. I felt like it was time to do something on my own. And I was always curious about asset management. So it felt like a good opportunity.
Yeah, so you moved to London.
No, I wish. Actually, it was based in Oslo, but I was supposed
Yeah.
to commute to London. I mean, I could go to London as often as I wanted to.
Okay.
So the plan was to go once or twice a month. And that job was very, very independent. And a lot of the people on the international sales team actually worked other places than Oslo from home. And then they would just travel a lot.
So at
So
least you didn't have to convince your boyfriend again.
No. He was very happy with that, actually, because
Yeah.
it was because of that job that we decided that we could move to his hometown, Larvik, actually,
Yeah.
which is
Yeah.
a little bit outside Oslo.
Yeah. So how did you meet with your co-founder, Christina, and how did you actually come up with the idea to create this kind of like social investing platform? Was it the personal experience? Was it the gap you saw in the market while you were working? Tell me more about it.
So I met Christine actually through our husbands. So they worked together in McKinsey, and they became close friends. And so we've had lots of couple dinners. And McKinsey also has a spouse club. It's not a joke. It's a thing. And so we had a spouse events where, you know, they would pay for like wine courses and food making courses and other,
Really?
yeah. I mean, and it was like a really cool group of women. They were all like hardworking women in cool jobs. So it
Yeah.
wasn't like stay-at-home wives only, sort of making dinner. It was like going to luxury restaurants, while McKinsey was paying. So we were very happy with that. I was
Yeah.
actually really, really sad when they threw me out of the group, because he quit. But never mind. So that's where I met Christine.
Yeah.
And I also always thought that she was very cool. And she always looked very good, and she had all these cool jobs. She was a product manager for Chanel makeup and also for Gucci Beauty here in Norway. And then her last job was actually in Vita, where she was responsible for buying cosmetics into the largest cosmetics chain in Norway. So she had like a huge budget. I think it was like 600 million. So I was always very
Yeah.
impressed with her and thought that she had very cool jobs. My grandmother, she also imported cosmetics to Norway for 40 years. She was sort of my big role model as a child, running her own
Wow.
business and being this fancy businesswoman who always looked very good, of course,
Yeah.
importing cosmetics. So we had a lot to talk about. And she was on maternity leave when I had this idea. It came to me working in Pareto Asset Management because I'd been working with stocks and bonds in Pareto and
Yeah.
selling these securities through the brokers, right? The brokers, they talk to the funds. But sometimes we would have sort of direct conversations with the funds. And I was always curious about how the funds worked and, you know, how they decided which things to buy and not. And so when I started working in asset management, I was quite surprised about how little I actually knew. I thought I had some kind of idea. but it was very different. And I read all the books, you know, about why you should invest in funds. I mean, obviously, I was going to be selling funds, so I wanted to learn a bit more. And I just realized that this was a really, really smart product, not just for the institutional kinds, which I would be covering, but I mean, for my friends, for myself. I mean, I'd only been buying stocks. I had one ETF. That was the only thing. And when I bought that ETF, it was Oslo Stock Exchange index fund. I didn't even know the difference between buying it in ETF format and buying a mutual fund.
Yeah.
And so I realized, okay, this is me. I've been working already when I started that job 6 years in finance. I have a master's degree in finance. How does it look like in the rest of society? And I had an investing evening at my place with some friends from NHH and one who was a photographer at the time. And she was actually the one who invested the most, the photographer.
Wow.
Yeah. All the rest, even if they were, you know, high paid women in relationships, no children, owning apartments, like really, really good with money and, you know, good paying jobs, none of them had an investing strategy. They weren't really putting money into funds. Or stocks, for that sake. Some of them had some funds, you know, I got some for my confirmation. Yeah, I have some stuff lying around, but there's really no strategy. And this was January 2020. So it was right before COVID. And obviously, so many of them did start doing stuff after that. There's been a huge development in the Norwegian market during COVID, and I think as well globally. But it was at that moment when I realized, okay, there is potential to do something in this market. I mean, women especially are leaving money on the table. Yeah. So that was sort of the one side of it. I saw that there was a market. And then once you start digging into it, why are women doing so little and how much money are they leaving on the table? You start getting really, really engaged because the statistics are terrible. Right. Even yeah. After COVID, DNB just released a report here last week. So this is fresh figures post COVID, post everything that happened. People had lots and lots and lots of money to invest and time to learn how to invest. Still, after that boom, only 25% of stocks and mutual funds. So that's including mutual funds.
Yeah.
Only 25% is owned by women.
Which is crazy. I know other statistics from 2023 where we have, like, in, for instance, the US, we know that 32%, only 32% of all investment accounts in the US were held by women. So we have much more to do. We just need to navigate through what the ways are to actually navigate to how to reach out to women and make sure that they get. I think it's because we need to get educated and we need to have fun while we're doing it. Could that be a possibility?
Exactly. Yeah. I so much agree. Because at the time when we started thinking about Stack, we saw that there are companies trying to target women. But what they do is very often make like a really simple solution, like a savings robot. Like, okay, you shouldn't have to think about anything. You shouldn't have to know anything. You just click here and we will invest for you. And the problem with that is that the regulations are quite strict. So first of all, those robots tend to give you very poor advice because they tend to be a lot more risk averse than you would be if you understood the risk yourself. I've tested this on many people and myself included. They started adjusting for it a little bit so that you in the end can drag up your... what they do is they typically give you too much interest rate funds compared to stock funds. Yeah. And then in the end now, they started putting a button where you can actually drag it to 100% stocks if you want to. But to do that yourself, right, you need to have knowledge. So you're not going to do that unless you have some knowledge. So it felt like knowledge was key. We need to be giving our users that knowledge in a fun and simple way. And it was actually Christine's idea to try and make the app more like social media, right? We are hanging around there a lot every day, scrolling because it is, well, entertaining, right? Yeah. And also on Instagram and TikTok, you see a lot of educational content, which does really well. So we were thinking, okay, the content needs to be in that format, short videos, snappy videos with like key highlights on the screen, etc. And also it needs to be social, right? Because we very quickly understood that the decision-making process for our target group, which is women sort of 20 to 45, is very often a social process. So you can either go on YouTube and do a lot of research yourself Or you can just ask a friend. And in our target group, those who had started investing, almost 95% of them said that that's how they got started. They asked a friend, they got a tip, and they did that. And then they didn't know where to go from there. So they tended to invest very little because it sort of stopped there, because they also didn't know who else to talk to it about. And so it felt like we needed to make an arena where it's easy to see what other people are doing without actually having to like interact or talk so much about it because it's kind of taboo. But then we also thought, okay, well, once you can actually see who's investing, you can see them in the app and you can see what they're doing. It's also easier to bring up the conversation because you know they invest. And then you can ask, oh, so why did you do that? And that looks cool. I want to do the same. Do you think that's a good idea? And yeah, so we wanted to
So
make a
you're
platform.
basically kind of like putting together new trends that are coming up, which is like, the micro learning, and this demand for like short form educational content that is like more fun and gamified learning, I would say, experience, kind of investing in that, but also like the social media and the influencers who are actually playing a growing role in influencing people and young adults, especially in how to invest and how to make these investment decisions, right? And instead of using that, you're actually combining these two and using your community and your friends and people you probably look up to. That would be basically sharing what they are doing on this platform, on Stack by Me platform, right? Which is amazing, yeah, because it opens up for conversations. It makes you more, let's say, open about talking about money and how to invest in a totally different way.
That's the goal, because our goal is not just to close the capital gap. Obviously, that's one of our part goals. But like you and Feminvest, right? We also believe in female ownership. It's so much more than just investing into global index funds. It's about developing the ecosystem, right? We need women not just to invest in global index funds. That should be a big part of your stack, as we call it, your portfolio. A building stone, really, the foundation of your stack should be either global index funds or Nordic or Norwegian, whichever you prefer, cheap sort of broad funds. But on top of that, you should not be ashamed of buying single stocks, buying startups, supporting causes that you believe in, buying active impact funds, buying active tech funds, buy whatever the fuck you want. If you believe in it, that's your decision to make. And your money, you can put exactly where you want it to be. And so I'm sort of very vocal in the debate here in Norway about it, because I feel very frustrated every time I see people commenting in the newspaper like, why don't you just buy in a global index fund? It always performs better. And that's not true. That's not even true. It has performed incredibly well in Norwegian crowns the past 10 years, because just the past 5 years, the crown has decreased against the dollar with 25%. So that's
Yeah.
25% return just there. And then, of course,
Exactly.
the big tech stocks, the Magnificent Seven, they have performed extremely well. So there's just like a few very, very large companies that have driven a lot of returns the past 10 years. But mathematically, that is really, really difficult to replicate the next 10 years, because those companies are now so big.
Exactly.
So it doesn't mean that the next 10 years will look the same. If you look at the past 40 years, the Norwegian Stock Exchange has actually performed better than the S&P 500. So why aren't we telling people to buy Norwegian Stock Exchange index funds instead of the global index funds? It's because it's very, very difficult for the human mind to stop extrapolating trends. So if it has happened the past 10 years, it's sort of an established truth. And so we try to take that voice that it's okay to do other stuff, and while you're at it, maybe actually like practice understanding the dynamics of the market and practice taking higher risks. I mean, the theory is, and it's very often true, the higher risk you take, up until a certain point, of course, the higher your expected returns are.
Definitely, yeah.
And so if you go to small cap funds, that is higher risk. It's supposed to give you higher expected returns over time. So if you have a very long time horizon, why not go there? If you believe in tech, for example, I am a tech founder, so I fundamentally believe it's going to drive a lot of the growth over the next 30 years, even though it's very, very highly priced at the moment. I still believe it can be a very, very good, and it can give you more returns than a global index can over the next 10 years. So I choose to put some of my money in tech funds. And it's about that, right? Giving people that comfort of, saying, I believe in this, I take this choice, so I'm going to put my money there. And if it doesn't go my way, okay, fine. At least it was a decision I took based on knowledge, which could have given me greater returns. You know what I mean? And from
Yeah.
there, I think it's easier to take those steps of like talking to your daughters about it, engaging them, buying single stocks, becoming owners of companies, becoming professional investors, because that's what we really, really need. We need more women in finance jobs, working the big funds, taking the board positions from being great owners, also more women becoming entrepreneurs and becoming successful entrepreneurs with exits, angel investing in new female entrepreneurs, so that we also get more tech, more businesses focused where a woman's mind would focus, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, definitely. That's how we are also working, aiming to create this ecosystem of women supporting women and accelerating women's ownership in different ways. So you already brought up the question that I had for you about like your thoughts on the future of social investing and its impact on financial landscape. And you've been like talking about the trends and the personalized investments advice using AI, the rise of social investing, and how to actually try to take more risks and more informative decisions and educated decisions using the micro learning, for instance, as a tool. If we go back a little bit about like how you left your job, like which was you had everything. It was highly challenging. It was fun. It was a high position to being an entrepreneur and working from zero. This platform. How was this journey? What was the challenges and the hurdles that you kind of like now look back at and think, oh, these were deadly attacks, but I made it. I made it through. And what were the learnings from these lessons that you went through together with Christine?
So we were rookies when we started out back. I must say, I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur because I had my grandmother who started her own company when she was 40, and she was sort of always the head of the family. She made a really, really nice salary, and she like gave out the dividends as well every year to my father and his brothers. But she would still always be the one. My father was a single father. And a pilot, so he would sometimes have to work off odd hours. So she would be the one picking us up, taking us on holidays, working a lot, but at the same time being super flexible. So I really wanted that. And so I've sort of always been looking for something to start. And that was one of the reasons I quit Pareto Securities to go to asset management. It was because I didn't see what I was going to start staying in securities. There wasn't really space for me to grow there. You can kind of be your own entrepreneur in Pareto Securities, but the field that I was working with was kind of taken, and my boss was only like 7 years older than me, so she wasn't going to retire.
Yeah.
So I felt kind of stuck, but moving to asset management, I was like, okay, well, that's cool. I can start this UK venture, and then once I've learned how the business rolls, I'm going to start my own fund. Haha. That was my
Yeah.
thinking anyways. One of the first things I did was to pitch in a new fund to the to ask Pareto. But I quickly learned that, the business is a little bit different than how I thought. But so it was very natural for me when I finally felt like, oh, I have an idea. This is something which can fly. COVID hit in 2020, which made my job a lot less challenging, I would say. I couldn't travel to London, and working sales in asset management, you're not going to get the big tickets without them doing site visits, without them meeting you. So you could like sort of start a relationship and start sending them newsletters, etc. But like closing of big deals wasn't going to happen until we could meet. Working over Teams with sales, it's not the same as going out to meet people, having, making personal connections and all the fun parts of working with sales. So I really felt like I had more capacity and that I wasn't being challenged enough in the job that I had. And so I started working on the stack on the side while I was still in Pareto. And then we got some funding, some soft funding. I asked Christine, and she was on maternity leave, and she was like, "Yeah, cool. Let's work a little bit on this, while I'm on maternity leave and see, how it pans out." And it kind of just the snowball started rolling. We got some funding. We made an MVP. We got an investor because we thought we were going to get more soft funding, but we actually didn't. But then we asked, "Okay, but you still want to put in those 300,000?" And the investor said, "Yeah, sure. Do that. I think it's a really good idea." And I think if he hadn't done that, we probably would have just closed shop. Nobody had put in any money. We hadn't sacrificed too much time. But he made me think that I wasn't crazy. So I was like, okay, well, it could be fun to do this. So, I mean, then let's do it. We used those 300,000. We were accepted into this accelerator program called The Factory, which was also a boost. Both for our confidence, but also, yeah, it gives you more structure around how you're supposed to work. We had this demo day in November, so that meant, okay, and for that demo day, we need to have our product ready so we can showcase it. We want to win that demo day. And at that point, I was actually 9 months pregnant, so I took 1 month of maternity leave before I gave birth so I could work full time with Zach. And then I worked during my maternity leave. So I had some income during the first 9 months of Stack. And Christine had also been on maternity leave. And so we actually fundraised our first round. It was slightly before I went on maternity leave. The investor who was supposed to take the whole deal, he actually backed out 3 weeks after I gave birth. So we had to start over.
Yeah, what a challenge.
Yeah. And at that point, I thought, okay, we are closing shop. And Christine was like, "Oh no, we just have to find someone else." I was like, "Okay, well, yeah, we can try." And somehow winning the part final of the accelerator program gave us a boost, both mentally and also with investors. And we had a larger ticket come in. We had around 1 million in small tickets, and then we got in almost a full million from this particular constellation called Askeladden. So it's basically a fund in Norway that sets up new companies, but more sort of retail brick and mortar kind of companies, and then they digitalize them. And it wasn't the fund, but it was the employees of the fund who sort of, they had a company benefit that they set up SPVs for them so they can co-invest. And they did. So they were a large ticket. And then we were sort of at two, and we were only raising 3 to 3.5. So then we were like, okay, we're getting there. Had no idea how we were supposed to get the final 1 million. But then people started calling me. It's just like in the movies, like, can I invest ½ a million? And I'm like, here, can
Yeah.
I have your signature here, please? And then finally, we were oversubscribed. We had more than 4 million in subscriptions, and we allocated 3.5. So then we could take out salaries, not big ones, but some. And it was, yeah, we had to sort of just go in 100%.
That
And then
sounds
from
lovely.
there on, it's just been like that all the time. The whole way, it's been like very, very last minute. Like, we've managed to get the funding, we've managed to reach some milestones. And then if so many people, because the second round was a crowdfunding where we got 380 new investors. If so many people think we're not crazy, then maybe we're not. So it's always given some optimism to us, even though it's really, really tough. We've had some really, really lows before. I mean, we went without salary for almost 3 months before we managed to do our second fundraise of 10 million. But then, after 3 months of being unpaid, right, we were oversubscribed again, right? We were raising 6 to 10 million. And I'm sure we could have raised 13 with the momentum that we had. But unfortunately, the way when you do crowdfunding, you can't raise more than 1 million without having a prospectus, 1 million euro. And also Folkinvest, which is the platform we used in Norway, they're very strict that to raise X amount of money, you need to have committed 20% before you go live. So since we only had 2 million committed, they wouldn't allow us to raise more than 10. I was a little bit annoyed at the time, but that's how they're set up. So we raised the 10.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So you managed to do the crowdfunding, you managed to find the investors, even though you had someone dropping off at like, and you were just 3 weeks after your maternity leave. It's amazing.
No. The first round when we had to redo the fundraise, I was 3 weeks into my maternity leave. I had a 3-week-old
Oh
baby.
my God. Oh my God.
The second
Amazing.
round, I was working full time. But our third round, we just finished a new fundraise of including soft funding around 11 million NOK.
And that was in 2023 now in autumn, right?
Yeah, in December. So it's actually not registered yet. We're waiting for the registration. So it's going to be on paper a 2024 deal. But that deal we actually did while I was on my second maternity leave. So I'm just
Amazing.
back.
I mean, given the circumstances and the landscape of capital raising at the moment, it's just an amazing step to go through this, but also like doing it not once, twice, actually 3 times, and manage to do it is, I mean, it's amazing. I'm really
Thank
happy to
you.
hear that. So what are your like, now that we've been talking about all these crazy stuff that you've been going through for raising capital, what are your like future plans for the next, I mean, the next year and the next 5 years from now?
Yeah, so before we go into that, though, I'd really like to say that the reason we managed to do it is because we've had women investing into us. So I've seen on LinkedIn people commenting like, oh, it won't help to have more female investors because they judge female founders the same. I don't agree with that. For all our rounds, we've had more than 50% female investors. So we wouldn't have been able to close without them. And in
I
our
love
last,
that fact.
yeah, and in our last and final round, 70% of our investors were women.
And that's
70%.
something we really, that's, I'm really happy you brought it up because we really need to emphasize the fact that women are actually willing to invest. They have the capital. We just need to give the time to actually the possibilities to shine and tell people that we have women who are entrepreneurs who are doing a great job. Even they are on maternity leave, they are finding the investors, and most of them are actually women. It's just amazing. And I think we should bring that up even more. And that's why we're doing these episodes of our interviews with the female entrepreneurs, because it's like I'm really fascinated by the facts that we get about women investing in the most difficult times. Really lovely.
Another specificity was in our last round, there were actually 600 investors for 9 million of capital. And the ticket size, so in our when we did our 10 million round, the ticket size on average was 25,000. In our last round, it was 15,000. And I think that's as a result of two things. One, interest rates have gone up. People have less, they feel like they can't just throw away 25K like they did in the first round. I mean, because when you invest in a startup, you have to be willing to lose that money, right? It's not like buying a fund. It's really, really high risk. And in the last round, that sort of amount had gone down a little bit. But I also think it's because women are quite sensible investors. When you invest into a startup and you might lose that money or that the risk is very high, you should diversify. So instead of investing, all of your excess money in stack, put in a little bit, and then you can put in a little bit in 10 other startups, which is a really, really smart way of doing it. So I was really glad actually when I saw that statistic.
And actually, that also like confirms the need for this kind of platforms for investing. So like women see exactly what the point is with Stack by Me and see that this is something that we need and we actually should work to make sure that you survive and Stack by Me survive and that we get to educate and help other women invest and accelerate their ownership, of course. So the last question, what are your future plans for the next year and the next 5 years? I'm really curious because, I mean, given what you have done so far, I'm like, I have big expectations for you to achieve things.
So do we. We're launching a new app now in March. So the app that we have out now in Norway, you can buy mutual funds there. But it's really like our MVP, which we just continued building on. So we're replacing all the tech into a much more stable, high performing tech stack, which is scalable, but also, you know, feels more modern. We have actually a Swedish investor, Ventures, who has come in now, who's were helping us with design and some growth hacking and making campaigns for that launch. We're really, really happy with them. And so it's just going to look a lot better as well. And now all the video content which we've made with the fund managers and ourselves, it's in standing format. It's, you know, everything about it feels more like social media. And the database that we use now is more the database that social media platforms use today. So it'll be easier for us to give that social media feel that we want to give. So really, really excited about that. I hope we'll find product market fit with that product. And then we're going to spend a lot of money on marketing to get the user growth that we need to raise our next round. And hopefully, within the end of the year, we also want to launch in Sweden. So our tech stack is basically Swedish now in the back end. So they've kind of made it into a Norwegian tech stack, or they're working on that now together with us. It'll actually be easier technically to just launch in Sweden. So we're really, really excited about that. First, of
Lovely.
course, first things first, we are going to launch in Norway and get the user growth and get see that it's working and all that. But that can go pretty quickly while we're at it. And then the plan is to show that we have ambitions to go further out than just little Norway, so we can justify raising a larger round, so that we can actually start scaling outside of Norway.
Lovely. Lovely. So I, as a Swedish customer, would I be able to download the app now and start using it, or is it only in Norway?
You can access it in Sweden, but you can't buy anything. You have to have Norwegian bank ID.
Yeah,
So
but
for
that's
now, it's just the
hopefully.
old app. Within new app, we will also have more courses and stuff in English. So it can be worth downloading to do the academy stuff.
Yeah.
And then come say Q4, I hope we'll also have opened for buying mutual funds, at least in Sweden.
Yeah. Lovely. So we'll have to take another podcast about that, probably at the end of the year then.
Yeah, that would be
Yeah.
really cool.
Yeah. Madeleine, thank you so much for being here today. We're coming to an end. It was really, really entertaining and educating and interesting to talk to you about all these facts you brought up about women investing, about the stocks, about how behavior is actually changing and the challenges that you've been through. But you insisted and you made it. I'm really happy that you were here today, and I look forward to follow your journey within the coming few years and see what kind of huge things you can achieve in the future. I'm certain about that.
Thank you for having me. Really lovely to speak with you.
Thank you. Bye.